Thank you, and good afternoon. This is the youngest panel I've ever been a member of. So this old baby boomer now will present to my millennia and Gen X colleagues up here today on the future of immunizations. I'd like to certainly go on the theme of increasing vaccine coverage to monumental levels. I love that theme of your conference this year. And it's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank my colleagues from ASCO for helping me in the preparation of this presentation, particularly Anna Buchanan, who's sitting in the back. Don't stand up, you might have that baby. And to Beth Rowe West, who runs our immunization program, and she is sitting in the back over there. North Carolina Public Health is an enterprise of state and local health. We have 85 health departments that do the groundwork. The State Division of Public Health is in the Department of Health and Human Services and provides technical assistance and quality assurance to the programs at the ground level that is mainly carried out by local health agencies. In my presentation over the next 10 or 12 minutes, I want to talk about health reform implications for immunization policy and practice at the state level. Unlike the federal government, the states cannot borrow money from China or India or Brazil. We have to have balanced budgets at the end of the year, except for maybe California. To achieve that, the state relies heavily on these federal funds to get the job of public health done. I would say that approximately 75% of our budget is federal, and most of the 25% state appropriation is dedicated to maintenance of effort and matching dollars to pull down those federal dollars. So there's really very little left in pure state appropriation. So I'm going to talk about the 317 immunization program, the private and public insurance coverage, population health and prevention, and community and school-based health centers as just examples of alternative sites where we can expand immunization coverage, all in health reform. Note that I'm not saying health care reform. I view this legislation as being the most important prevention legislation ever passed in the history of the nation. Section 317 in health reform, reauthorization of the immunization program, as was already mentioned by Craig, is in there. And as I learned, there's a substantive portion on immunizations in the bill language. So all of you legal nerds out there want to go home and look this up because it is about a 3,000-page bill or law now, 1 year ago. Section 4204 covers immunizations. Perhaps one of the most important provisions is there. States will be able to purchase recommended vaccines for adults at a federally negotiated price. This will be huge because now our local health departments to do flu clinics go on to onto the marketplace to purchase their vaccines if there is no 317 money available. So this will be like the VFC program where states purchase at reduced price on a federally negotiated contract. The law will allow that for adult immunizations as well. It also will fund demonstration programs to improve immunization coverage, and this includes grants to states for high-risk populations, and I'll review that in a moment. It does require a state plan on how these interventions will match local needs, so communities are always doing community health assessments and local needs assessments, and how that will match up with the state plan. And we'll fund programs such as reminders and recalls, education, reducing out-of-pocket costs, as you heard about, home visits, automated registries, and many other pieces of the immunization puzzle. Insurance coverage and health reform, as we've heard, first dollar coverage, that is the premium only for all preventive services as recommended by ACIP and the United States Public Services, United States Prevention Services Task Force. Again, this is a big deal in the private market. Of course, grandfathered plans will be exempt. How you define grandfathered is huge and long, and I'm not going to bore you with that. But I can't believe the definition that exists for a grandfathered plan. Public insurance includes Medicaid and Medicare. If states implement, according to the law, they will expand coverage to 133% of the federal poverty level This is for people who are just meet those financial criteria. No longer will you need to be disabled medically to get Medicaid, and that will be big in North Carolina, a lot of the Southeast. I know my colleagues in the Southeast U.S. will see this as a huge expansion of the program. If states do that and implement the first dollar, not the first, but the prevention services in ACIP and USPSTF, they will receive a 1% FMAP increase. That's the federal match in the Medicaid program. Our state actually has done an analysis, and our governors, believe me, across the nation are still very concerned about this being affordable at the state level. And indeed, the numbers don't quite add up yet in North Carolina, and this is going to be a challenge as states begin to implement this part of the law. Medicare will pay for annual wellness visits with recommended prevention services, so that annual visit is the time to get all caught up with our seniors in that program. In prevention and population health, you heard about the $15 billion fund over 10 years. A lot of that went to CDC, and it's funding activities at the state level now. North Carolina was one of 14 states to receive both Component 1 and Component 2 funding channels of that grant. In North Carolina and in other states, it is funding performance management across the enterprise of public health, including quality improvement activities and increasing health data needs that the states always have, like in our immunization registries or our vital records department, including automated death certificates and birth certificates, which is a big expense for states. And there is also mention of the Community Preventive Services Task Force that will be formed under the law to oversee these large amounts of money. Now, we heard about the issues with 2011 because right now we're at level funding, and we're hoping for level funding in 2011 and the future, because about $250 million went to this public health and prevention and public health fund when it was originally supposed to be $500 million. Maybe my White House colleague can talk about how half of it went to fund primary care residency programs. But if I can keep... if I can keep level funding, I will be happy in this economic climate. I think every state would probably agree with me on that. In the public-private partnership realm, prevention and health promotion outreach campaigns, including measures supported by the ACIP, are all written into the law. In health centers, North Carolina, who's delivered a lot of primary care services to their local health departments, like many states in the Southeast, has seen a huge influx in community health centers, and these are known as the federally qualifying health centers or FQHC-like centers, $9.5 billion through HRSA to pay for capital investment and to staff them through the National Health Service Corps. The challenge for states like North Carolina is to make sure they are not competing with local health departments who see their role as primary immunizers for their communities. And how that is done must be worked out carefully at the local level. It will also cover low-cost immunizations for under and uninsured. It's estimated that after full implementation, if Congress doesn't mess with it anymore, in 10 years, still 8% of the general population will be under or uninsured. So there will still be a big need out there despite full implementation as written into law now. School-based health centers is another example where you can reach underserved communities. $200 million was in appropriated in the first year. And this gives us an opportunity to vaccinate more during the school day. In North Carolina, we struggle just to get school nurses up to the proper ratio of one to every 750 students. We only have one nurse for every 2,000, roughly, in North Carolina, maybe even less than that. Now, I see this expansion really is helping us in the adult vaccine world because VFC has been so huge for children, and with expansion of the private insurance realm and ACIP, we think kids are going to be covered. So it's important to look at some of these adult programs that are going to be coming out through Section 317 expansion. If you look at some of these programs that high-risk individuals, that local health departments do, in terms of prenatal care. They are the primary providers of Medicaid moms in North Carolina. About 75% of Medicaid moms get their prenatal care at local health departments in my state. But we'll be seeing these vaccines distributed more to drug treatment centers, HIV STD clinics, family planning clinics. Title 10 family planning, again, is also implemented at the local health department level in North Carolina, and jails and prisons. So these alternative sites that are outside the usual clinic setting where you really need to get hepatitis vaccines. Hep B, completion of series for those receiving at least one dose prior to their 19th birthday, and also in a post-exposure prophylaxis. These are important adult programs that currently it's really hard to get done. And in our control measures, you just look at all these vaccine-preventable diseases. I mean, pertussis is endemic in the United States and continues to be a problem. So getting these control measures out, you need to purchase and have vaccines readily available for rather significant and large outbreaks that are occurring every day in our country. Varicella, hepatitis B and A, and even measles, mumps, and rubella. All standard control measures that are usually at the state level written into law or rule, that is, they are mandated and under the police powers of states for control measures of communicable diseases. Moving on to the influenza vaccine, again, in adult vaccination programs, very helpful and for immunizing uninsured and underinsured adults. And as I said, even after full implementation, it's estimated that 8% of the population will still fall into that category. Pregnant women who are at very high risk for complications to influenza. Non-traditional settings such as the Vote and Vaccinate program. What a great opportunity on November 2nd or November 4th when you are all voting to get your flu shot. It's the perfect time of year. Human papillomavirus in colleges and universities. Why not get a young women and now young men? Because now we can use it in young men as well. Family planning clinics, HIV STD clinics, uninsured and underinsured adults again. So again, these are all these areas that public health at the state and local level are constantly dealing with. And then the Menactra or the quadrivalent meningococcal vaccine. Prior to college entry, some states have mandated this. We have not in North Carolina, but it is highly recommended. Some colleges mandate it, so and by default it becomes something that has to get done. Adult vaccines, continuing with the Tdap vaccines, and these are just some of the settings that we are working with in getting adults vaccinated. Again, family planning clinics, pregnant women, the cocooning program, particularly for pertussis, where you're trying to protect that newborn who cannot be immunized, who has no passive immunity from maternal passage through the placenta and is very prone, so you got to really cocoon that infant. And these programs are ongoing all the time through C317 funds. School staff, particularly during outbreaks, child care staff, same thing. Healthcare workers, particularly when they're not funded by their employer, which is a lot of times the case, like in long-term care facilities and other places that don't have robust occupational health programs. Uninsured and underinsured adults, again. So I'm going to highlight some states that Beth Rowe West got for me from that's going around the country now, looking at adult vaccine projects. Georgia is looking at a household and sexual contacts of hepatitis B virus positive individuals seen in public health clinics. They get one free shot. Now, Georgia's like us. It's a family of local health departments. They have even more counties than we do. Anyone from Georgia here? Yeah, am I right? 140 or something? Yeah.
159.
How many?
159.
I only have 85 because at least 100 of our counties, some of them have decided to districts. But when you're dealing with that many local health departments, it's a challenge. Wyoming is providing HPV vaccine at the University of Wyoming for students ages 19 to 26. Michigan, insured and underinsured adults seen in local health departments. all across the nation, New York City, influenza and pneumococcal vaccines at 100 locations throughout the city. I got to get on my asthmatic son who works and lives in Brooklyn and never gets the flu shot. I'm sure there's one near his apartment. Nebraska, Tdap vaccine at 64 birthing hospitals for mothers of newborns. Again, non-traditional sites. So in conclusion, health reform, not health care reform, is not controversial. It should not be prone to the partisan politics that affect health care reform and mandated insurance issues that are now facing us at the state level as we try to implement this very exciting legislation. It really is bringing prevention into practice, and it will, if implemented fully as intended, it will result in monumental increase in vaccination rates. I am convinced of that just by virtue of the first dollar coverage would be that one part. So I've reviewed Section 317, the insurance coverage issue, performance management that is being funded through CDC at the state level, and really doing quality improvement projects across the board in public health, but including immunizations, will really help that enterprise of public health that takes place at the federal, state, and local level to improve. And then access to care, looking at all sorts of alternative sites where we can get these vaccines to the people that need it. Thank you.
Anybody have any questions? If so, please come to the microphone.
Hi. Several of you mentioned more than once the first dollar coverage for vaccines under the Affordable Care Act. And in South Carolina, we're one of the states that's working on the Billables Project. And in planning for that project, the fact that most of the large insurers in the state have grandfathered status, and without knowing the timing of when they might lose that status, planning is very difficult over the Billables Project. Do you have any information or indication as to what you think that timing will be?
It's a good question. I think that one of the challenges we had when we were talking about the Affordable Care Act is ensuring that, you know, when the president promised you can keep what you have if you like it, that people can keep what they have, you know, if they liked it. So that was part of the rationale behind the grandfathering plan. But one of the issues we see with a lot of these grandfather plans is just because you like what you have doesn't necessarily mean it probably could provide you the best benefits. So I think one of the things that we know with respect to the grandfather plans is, and I may be a little rusty on the estimate, but it's believed by 2013 up to, I think it's like 80% of the grandfather plans will change. And there's some, it's a very complicated issue because health insurance plans aren't static. There are a lot of things that occur throughout sort of their normal course. So there was some safeguards built in there for sort of the normal, you know, increase in premiums or changing of services and that sort of thing. So the sense is that, you know, probably by 2013, 2014, the majority of the grandfather plans will be subject to these new rules.
It just sort of surprised me when you made the statement that, you know, that was considered to be one of the most important factors, that they required, like, coverage to age 26 immediately, that was exempted from the grandfather clause, but the first dollar coverage was not. So
I mean, and then that's an important observation. I think it's absolutely fundamental that we all recognize that this is a tremendous system that's very complex. There are a lot of moving pieces. It's really hard, and we were sort of cognizant of it, that we didn't want everything to change at once. It just wouldn't happen. This would be a failed experiment. So I think what happened is a lot of the conversations that were going on were figuring out what things are things that can happen right away, what are the things that we need to work on right away, and what things are going to take a little bit longer. And I think one of the things with respect to the first-dollar coverage is that there are a lot of challenges in making sure that, you know, if you have first-dollar coverage, someone has to pay for it. So how do we sort of figure out, how does that get built into the billing? How does, you know, where does that money come from? So there are a lot of different pieces that went into it. And, you know, the administration has a tremendous task, and we're working very closely with them to help sort of implement a lot of the provisions. But this is not an easy sort of transition. This is something that's very complicated. And there was a decision that was made in terms of what things would come out immediately and what things would be essentially, as we sort of went incrementally, what provisions would be implemented.
Again, this was a great presentation, and I thank you. My name is Gene Robert Jeffrey. I'm from Arizona. My first question is for the lady from OMB. What is exactly budget authority?
Budget authority is your basically discretionary resources. So a lot of we're hearing in the climate of what's the 2011 budget. A lot, when we talk about the budget authority, we're looking at mostly your discretionary resources, but then there are other resources that come in to CDC's overall funding. So it's one piece of their overall pie.
Okay. Second of all, with the new legislator coming to Washington with the great idea of just shutting down either the new Affordable Act or completely take some money, do you think we'll be able to survive that?
So we, you know, I think that it's a very complicated issue, and I think it's one of the things that, you know, I'll be quite frank, I think we haven't done a really good job in communicating what the benefits are, because I think a lot of people, you know, think of this as Obamacare, think of it as sort of like an overreaching of the government's powers, but there are a lot of pieces in there. When people really start hearing about different provisions, when you talk about dependent coverage, when you talk about sort of the first dollar coverage, there are things that a lot of people are supportive of. There have always been, even the individual mandate was originally a Republican idea. It's something that a lot of Republican senators have supported in the past. So, you know, it's an interesting sort of phenomena in terms of how this sort of got tied into sort of the politics of it. We work on defending it every day. You know, I don't think we expect it to be working this hard and this long. And I think, in all fairness, again, this is a difficult transition. This is something that's it's monumental. It's going to take a lot of talk. You know, we're going to have to figure out how things are implemented. We want to make sure it's implemented well. I think that a lot of the politics are involved in you know, trying to take away some of the funding. And essentially, this is, you know, this is an important evidence-informed experiment. But if you starve the system, it's not gonna work. And I think that's what really is going on here. People are trying to starve the system so that it fails, so they can say, look, this didn't work. Government shouldn't be doing this. But we still fight, because you can't minimize the fact that so many additional Americans are going to have access to insurance, that it's going to be better for them. They're going to have affordable care. We're going to, you know, a lot of the systems, you know, are set up to really sort of promote private entities, you know, promote private insurers and that sort of thing. So I think we will continue to fight our darnest. You know, I can say that because I work for a senior Democratic member. It's something that we feel is very important. We think there's a moral imperative to provide resources to individuals to get affordable care, and it's something that we'll continue to work on. And, you know, something that, you know, causes, there's a lot of disagreement, but that's definitely where we stand, and we're going to do our darndest.
I would just add that, as written, the law ramps up over a 10-year period of time, and it has actually affected very few Americans after year one. So I think it's going to take some time for the public to really get on board.
I want to thank you for all this wonderful information you've given to us. My name is Lori Hennessy. I'm from New York, and I just need some clarification. The first dollar coverage is a great start to eliminating some of the barriers for immunizations, and I'm very excited about that. But some of the people I see come to our VFC program, they already have insurance that covers it, but the physician's office visit is the factor. It's not covered by their insurance, and they just don't have the money to pay for that. Mm-hmm. Is that anywhere addressed in the new regulations in this law?
It's a good question. I think it's one of the things that we have been working with administration to work on. It's something that we didn't want to specify in statute, because what happens with regulations is there's a lot more flexibility to get the input of a lot of different stakeholders to make sure that it's a system that continues to move. So it's kind of a moving target in a lot of respects. So we needed to hear, you know, what people's thoughts are, you know, in terms of making this a more in terms of what I was saying previously, we want to make sure that there's incentives for the physicians to provide these services.
Absolutely.
So those type of activities and those conversations are ongoing. I don't know where it is in terms of the actual processes, but there has been conversations. There have been a number of stakeholder efforts to try to get the perspective of providers to be able to make this in such a way so that you can sort of, you know, how do we make this? We don't want this to be a disincentive. We really want to make sure that people are accessing this service, which means we need to think about the implementation, and something that we've been very active in working with our administration colleagues. So I don't have a definitive answer, but it's definitely something that we're well aware of and something that we're working on.
Okay. And my second question is another clarification. For the first dollar covered, is that through a certain age? Some insurances, some people come in to me and say, oh, we're covered up to 6 years, but after that we have no coverage for immunizations. So with this new law, does that cover up to 26 for immunizations?
Yes, it covers everyone. I mean, everyone in private, employer, group, individual.
Age
Medicare.
0 to 150.
I mean, we didn't.
Which is where we're going with the new law, because it's prevent.
I think in my conversation or in my presentation, I talked a little bit about some of the challenges we have with adults in Medicaid. That's the one place that we weren't able to establish parity. So some states may cover it, some states may not. So that's definitely a challenge. But as the rules currently exist, everyone should have access to it, you know, if they have those type of providers. There's no age limit on it. We stayed away from, especially with a lot of the children in EPSDT, we wanted to make sure that a lot of people think those are generally good benefits. I know there's some questions and concerns. So really sort of that adult population was that are Medicaid beneficiaries, which always is the challenge, was one of the places we weren't able to get parity.
Okay, thank you.
But we're not done. You know, this is, like my boss likes to say, this is our starter home. There's so much more that needs to be done, and we're going to continue to work on it. That's why this is why it's important that we're out here talking to you all, that you communicate your ideas, your concerns, the challenges. That way we can have this sort of be, you know, a very sort of didactic process, that we're having those conversations, we're able to sort of adapt as things move on.
Great, thank you.
Thank you all for a fine set of presentations. Ray Strickus, Immunization Services Division, CDC Atlanta. Question for Dr. Engel. I'm not sure I understood if the things you described as far as adult immunization activities in North Carolina are things you're doing now, you would like to do, or some combination thereof. Can you elaborate?
A lot of our work in 317 and other areas are done through RFP process to local health departments, so it's a patchwork quilt in North Carolina. So it depends on the county's ability to write a competitive grant that is evidence-based and that they can monitor for success. So you're likely to see a very different story depending on what county you're in North Carolina because of the way we allocate federal dollars. We do try to take into account counties that are neediest, but a lot of times those are the same counties that have difficulty putting together a program that they could actually implement.
Thank you.
Hi, Jim Lutz, Philadelphia. Dr. Engel had mentioned that the grandfathering rules are complex. I hope I'm answering a yes or no question, but if not, please tell me. So a lot of states already have first hour insurance mandates on commercial plans for prevention funding like immunization. What does the Affordable Care Act do to those state, does it override those state insurance mandates?
I guess I'm not clear on what your question is.
Okay, for instance, Aetna is now required in Pennsylvania to ensure first hour coverage for vaccines for all folks, all insured through Aetna, right? They're also grandfathered in because, you know, okay. So Affordable Care Act comes in and says, okay, you're grandfathered. Can Aetna now say, well, we're deciding not to abide by the Pennsylvania requirement because ACA overrides the Pennsylvania first hour mandate?
So if I understand the context, so if they were to drop first dollar coverage, it would no longer be considered a grandfathered plan. Then they'd be subject to the regulations. So the goal is to get everyone to first dollar coverage. So if states are currently covering them, then they don't have to change anything. And if they were, for whatever reason, decide, there was changes to the plan, then again they don't become grandfather plan, so they would still be subject to the requirement.
Thank
so
you.
The end goal is the same for all plans.
Okay. All right. And the second part of that, now the ERISA exempt plan, say General Motors decides tomorrow to not provide group health insurance but self insure. The ERISA exemption that stands now, what happens to that under ACA as far as first hour prevention requirements?
Now you're expanding my beyond my horizons, you know, a little bit. I think the end goal again is sort of that all group plans will be subject to these statutory requirements. I mean, this is the law of the land in terms of providing first dollar coverage. They don't have to abide to that rule, but if they don't abide to the rule, and essentially they're going to be subject to a number of penalties for not being an active participant by being the outlier.
So I'm talking about companies self-insuring to provide health insurance to their employees.
The statute was codified in the ERISA code, so they would be eligible to these requirements also.